Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the people we love shape who we become and help us to recognize what's most important in life? Rod Dreher grew up in tiny St. Francisville, Louisiana, surrounded by loving family and neighbors, but he couldn't escape the sense that he didn't quite fit there and was destined for bigger places and greater things. That out-of-place feeling was magnified by the ease with which his younger sister Ruthie embraced small-town life. She loved everything about St. Francisville and its people, grew up to teach school, and happily settled down to raise a family of her own. When Ruthie was diagnosed with a virulent form of lung cancer at 40, she had literally everything to lose, but her relentless faith and optimism inspired the entire community and mobilized them to rally around her in a way that deeply touched her far-roaming brother and ultimately changed the course of his life. Rod Dreher is a writer for The American Conservative and former writer and editor for the Dallas Morning News. His new book is The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. He's in town for a book signing event this evening at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway. Rod, welcome to Think.
It's so great to be here and to be back in Dallas.
We're glad to have you back. So you write that growing up in St. Francisville, one cannot escape history. What did that mean for you as a kid?
St. Francisville is the quintessential Old South town. Lots of plantation houses. There was Civil War battles around there. And you grow up constantly aware that things happened here. And you grow up with the weight of generations after generations of your family having been there. And your people know the people down the road and have known them for the longest time. Some people who've helped my family out through all this, you know, their great uncles helped my grandfather rebuild the cottage that my dad was raised in during the Great Depression after a house fire. So when you live with this kind of history, and it changes you because you feel so rooted to the earth.
And you feel rooted, and yet when you're like a teenager who has visions of doing things for himself, was there a sense of, I don't always want to be known as this couple's son, as this person's brother?
Right. That's a really good point. You know, I'm always going to be Ray and Dorothy's son, no matter what. And that could be a good thing. You know, it can open doors for you. It can make people open their hearts to you because they may not know you, but they know your mom and daddy. But it also can limit you. And it limited me in a certain way because my father, Ray, and my sister, Ruthie, they did not think I should leave. They thought that the weight of the tradition was something that should anchor me to this place. And it was very hard for them to see that I could leave St. Francisville and West Feliciana Parish and still be faithful to them. And in that sense, the weight of tradition and of localism was a real burden on me.
Well, and it makes sense in a way that if your sense of self is defined by the place you come from, then anyone who doesn't define themselves in the same way, it feels like they're rejecting not the place, not the lifestyle, but you as an individual.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, my dad simply could not see how anyone who was raised there in the country, and this is a beautiful part of Louisiana, raised there in the hills on hunting and fishing and football games. How could you not want that? What's wrong with you? And as Ruthie thought, you think you're better than us? Mm-hmm. What we have is not good enough for you? And they couldn't see. You know, they took it so personally. And that grieved me, and it led to all kinds of fights. And it led to me ultimately leaving that and high school bullying.
Yeah, and the bullying thing is interesting, too, because, you know, one can imagine anyone who is I'm generalizing here because there's lots of smart people in small towns, but there's that sense that if you don't fit into the culture of a small town, it's worse than not fitting into the culture at a big school or a big city. But you had this chance to move to Natchitoches in the middle of high school.
That's right. I was in the first class of a school called Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts. It was a publicly supported boarding school for the gifted and talented. And I wanted to get up there to have, you know, more advanced classes. But more than that, I wanted to get out of a situation in which I was a perpetual outsider, picked on in school, and going home to my dad. And I was such a bookish kid, and he didn't understand me. He's a good man, one of the most intelligent men I've ever known, but he was a country boy. And he couldn't figure out how he could have a son who was interested in politics and ideas and things, and to the extent that I was. So I went to Louisiana School looking for home. And when I went up there, I found home. I found a community of people who shared the same interest and who may not have been exactly like me, but I didn't have to be embarrassed for being a kid who liked to read. And I felt embraced, and it became my home.
And so you and your sister grew up, you know, playing and fighting as kids do, but were temperamentally, it sounds like you couldn't have been more different. And maybe, you know, in the way that siblings do, you almost defined each other according to the way you were not like each other.
That's right. That's right. Ruthie was the country mouse. I was the city mouse. She was just like our dad. She embraced the hunting. I mean, I kid you not, she was the homecoming queen who knew how to use a shotgun to skin a buck. Mm-hmm. And she was really good in school. She made better grades than I did, but she was the dutiful daughter. And it was really interesting to me, Chris, to when I was working on this book, I needed to fill out the years in Ruthie's life in high school after I left for Louisiana school and then went on to LSU. I didn't know what it was like around there. Her husband, Mike, who had been her high school sweetheart, they married not long after high school. He gave me a trove of letters that she had written to him when he was at basic training. He's a year older, and he had gone off to basic training. And when she was preparing for her senior year of high school, she wrote him every day, sometimes twice a day. And these letters were such rich sources of details about what life was like in this small town in the 80s. But what was so revealing to me was how happy Ruthie was, how content with everything she had. She would write about fishing and going bowling with her friends in Baton Rouge, and she loved her life. She loved the world. She was at home in the world. She was the most well-adjusted 17-year-old you could possibly imagine. Me, on the other hand, when I was that age, and even when I was 19 and 20, I was just eaten up with anxiety, self-doubt. Does God exist? What is the meaning of life? You know, typical things. Very melodramatic, but we could not possibly have been more different. And as empathetic as she was in her life and over the course of her life, she couldn't empathize with me.
Do you think maybe, Rod, that she felt like happiness was a choice, maybe a choice that came easy to her, but that you were somehow choosing not to be happy with all these wonderful things that were presented to you?
Of course. That's exactly what it was. She would say, why can't you just be happy? And you saw this, too, later on in the story when she was trying to relate to her teenage daughter, Hannah, whom everyone from the very beginning said, oh, she's just like Uncle Rod, Hannah is. And when Ruthie and Hannah would fight, when Hannah became a teenager, she would say to Hannah, why can't you just be happy? But she couldn't understand why you live here in God's country. You know, mm-hmm. The air is clean. The pond is full of fish. The brim are biting. What's wrong with you?
You know, it's interesting to me because I don't think I understood families that didn't want their kids to move away if there was a better opportunity or go away to school or that would resist that until I had kids of my own. And I do expect them to leave at some point to go off to college and to maybe move away. But now I think I have a better sense of how hard that is to be the one left behind.
Yeah, to be the one left behind. And I really began to see this and to empathize with my parents when I had my first son. My wife Julie and I were living in New York City, and this was the late 90s, and we had our firstborn, and I was lying there with him. I'd lie with him at night in our apartment by the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and I'd tell him stories about Pawpaw, my dad, about the time my dad picked a rat snake found one in our chicken coop at home, and he whirled it around his head and snapped its head off like a whip. And my little boy loved these stories. Tell me about Pawpaw. Tell me more. And then I began to think, oh, I really hope this kid, wherever his journeys take him in life, that he'll stay close to his mom and me because I want to be part of his life. I want to be part of his story. And then I realized this is what Daddy wants for me too. And here I am in New York City, and I can't give it to him.
So tell us a little bit more about Ruthie. She sort of took to the place she was born, loved it very much. What kind of friend was she to the people she hung around with?
Ruthie was one of those extraordinary people you see in high school who was not petty. You know, she was a good time girl in the sense that she always was at the center of every party, every event, but she got along with boys and girls equally well. She did not gossip. She liked to do things with the boys. She liked to go hunting with them and fish with them, play golf. But she also got along with the girls because people knew she was a true friend, that when Ruthie said something, she meant it, and she was not going to play these silly games. And she would come home when we were in college. We were at LSU at the same time. She was 2 years behind me. She went home every weekend to be with Mike. Mike was her true love. They fell in love in high school, and they were once they got together, they were never again apart until the day she died in his arms. And she had everything she wanted right there. And I think she had this effect of on people of making them feel at home, too. People told me as I was writing the book, oh, your sister, whenever you would see her out in public at the supermarket or wherever, she always made you feel like you were the most important person in the world to her. And it was a rare gift. And I think part of it came from she really was at home in the world.
One thing that you had in common with her was that you each had a very strong faith that guided your life. But as you describe it, Ruthie's idea of faith was not what you thought about, but sort of what you, the way you acted. And for you, it was always, and I guess remains, kind of an intellectual exercise in addition to anything you might do.
That's right. And that is a profound difference between us and something that really has been significant as Ruthie's story with cancer has played out. I was always the seeker, and we were raised Methodist in St. Francisville, and that was good enough for Ruthie, but it wasn't good enough for me. I lost my faith as a teenager and then happened to go on a trip. My mom wanted a trip for two to Europe when I was 17 and sent me, and I'd always wanted to go to France. The tour bus stopped at the cathedral in Chartres, and I said, oh, a nice old church. Let's go see. I went in there and was transformed by the beauty and the majesty and the grandeur of this cathedral. And I didn't know what was going on, but something big was going on. The beauty of this place changed me. And a few years later, that started my journey to Catholicism. I recovered my faith and came into a mature Christianity because of my initial encounter with beauty and by reading books. Again, Ruthie and my dad thought, what, Methodism isn't good enough for you? Mm-hmm. That our family's tradition isn't good enough for you? But they didn't really care about theology. You know, for Ruthie, the whole of Christianity is Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And God loves me, and he's going to be with me, and he expects me to love others. That was all she knew, all she needed to know. I always wanted more. So I've journeyed through several forms of Christianity to where I am now as an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And I don't apologize for that because I was always a very sincere seeker. But Ruthie never could understand it. You know, she at college, I remember sitting there in the cafeteria with my best friend, Highland Cafeteria at LSU. And my friend and I were talking about our philosophy class, the death of God, Nietzsche. Ruthie sat down with us, listened to a little bit of that, and said, you guys are full of crap. You know, get out there and do something. You're just sitting around speculating. Go do something. And that's how she lived. Christianity was not something you thought about. It was something you did.
Well, and I think that ends up being a divide between people in the world, that kind of divide between the way people approach what's important to them keeps a lot of people from understanding one another.
That's really true. I mean, I remember at the time thinking that was really funny. My little sister, this is just a replaying their fights from childhood, and I condescended to her. And I will never endorse her anti-intellectualism. I mean, she was a math teacher, and math and science made perfect sense to her, but she thought speculating about the nature of God, the existence of God, that was nonsense. And I think she was wrong about that. But I have to say, too, what I've learned over the years is I could stand to have a lot more Ruthie Lemming in my life because my faith was something that was so intellectual, and it wasn't lived in the heart as it should have been.
My guest is Rod Dreher. He's a writer for the American Conservative and former writer and editor at the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Rod Dreher, who writes for the American Conservative and is a former writer and editor at the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. What did it take for Ruthie to get a proper diagnosis? She was young and healthy. She hadn't smoked. No one thought she could possibly have lung cancer.
Right. She started coughing in October of 2009, and nobody could figure out why. Her doctor thought it was allergies, or maybe it was a start of asthma. But the doctor she was seeing then didn't take it seriously enough. And Ruthie's friends kept saying to her, and my mom and dad said, you know, honey, you need to get a second opinion. But Ruthie being Ruthie, she thought it might hurt the doctor's feelings if she questioned his diagnosis. And she didn't want to be a bother to anybody. Well, finally, after the kids came back from their Christmas break, she was going up the stairs at her middle school, and she couldn't breathe, and the pain in her back was so great that her friends confronted her and said, you're going to go get a second opinion. Call Dr. Tim Lindsay, a young physician in town. Go see Tim. He'll tell you what's wrong with you. And so she finally did. And Tim was shocked when he saw her, ordered more tests. They were inconclusive. There were spots in her lung, but nothing else indicated cancer. By the time he ordered more tests, just a couple of weeks later, it was too late. And her oncologist told me that when he saw her then, she had about 2.5 months to live.
To make a long story short, she lived a lot longer than that, than 2.5 months. And it sounds like in some ways, her will had a lot to do with that.
Absolutely. Ruthie lived 19 months. And now the average time, well, not even the average, most people who have her kind of cancer don't survive 1 year past diagnosis. She made it 1.5 years, and her oncologist told me that he's absolutely convinced that the way she chose to deal with her cancer made an enormous difference. And I ended up finding out later, I wrote a piece for the Dallas News about this on Sunday, that the way Ruthie responded just by being Ruthie was exactly what medical science says they like to see in cancer patients. From the very beginning, I mean the first hour that they told her family, her girls, Mama has cancer, Ruthie looked at those girls and said, girls, we are not going to be angry at God. And Ruthie's idea was, I don't know why this has happened to me, but God has a plan here, and I'm not going to be mad. I'm not going to question his plan. I'm just going to have faith that he will walk with me no matter what. Well, that's one thing scientists are finding, that people who do have that confidence that there's meaning behind this, they become much more resilient. Ruthie prayed. Ruthie had a very strong social network of people around her because she had lived in the same place all her life. Those people were shattered. I remember flying from Philadelphia down to the hospital, and it was like a war zone. They could not believe this had happened to Ruthie. But she was the rock at the center of this. She was so serene and so filled with light. She was holding them all together. But that social network, the people who came by to take her kids to school, to feed them, to clean her house, just to care for her, that's another thing science says makes people more resilient. And her love of nature helped too. Ruthie always loved our dad's pond, from the time she was a child. She would take herself back to nature and sit by the pond and just think as she was struggling with chemo and life and death. And that, too, gave her a calm place within with which to resist the cancer. The one thing she didn't do, Chris, was to ask the doctor, how much time do I have left? In fact, she told him at their first meeting, the oncologist, don't give me that information because it can only sap my will to resist. That's completely not how I would do it. You know, I information is power for me. But for Ruthie, she thought information meant weakness. But I had to reflect that if I had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer as she was, out of the blue, never been a smoker, I would want to read every single thing, every book I had on my shelf. I would consult every priest and pastor and philosopher I knew. I would blog about it. I would talk about it. And at the end, I would hope to end up where Ruthie started out, saying, this is God's will, and I'm going to trust him and affirm life and live every day with a full heart and see what I can still do to help people.
How forthcoming was she with her daughters about the possibility, really the certainty that this would be the end of her life?
That is one of the great mysteries of this story. Ruthie didn't talk to her daughters about it. She sat down and told them everything she knew. And remember, she did not know for sure that she was going to die. She hoped she would live. She had to have known it would be a possibility. But Ruthie wanted to protect them from the pain and the anxiety of the fact that their mother was likely going to die. And that was her way. I can't approve of that. I wouldn't do it myself. But I'm in no position to judge how a young mother deals with her children in that way. But that was of a piece with Ruthie's life. You know, she did not want to speculate earlier in her life about the existence of God. Why do that? Why bring that worry on yourself? Of course he's there. By force of will, she believed it, and she moved on, got on with her life. Similarly with cancer, she didn't think about all these complicating things. I think it was a mistake for her to do that, but her daughters have told me they're so glad Mama did that, because if Mama hadn't, they said that we would have been eaten up with anxiety and fear every single day. We would have been paralyzed, and we would not have been able to enjoy the last 19 months she had with us.
You know, the other thing that's so interesting about that is it sounds like she communicated with them the way she would want to have been communicated with in the same situation had she been the daughter faced with the prospect of losing her mother, because thinking about it ahead of time really didn't give you much ability to do anything about it.
No, that's what she said. What can I do? You know, I'm doing everything the doctors tell me. Ruthie had a very strong religious faith, but she also had faith in her doctors. You know, she took hardcore chemo because she said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. You just tell me. Let me and God will handle it on one side, but I will listen to you, Dr. Militello. And Dr. Militello, her oncologist, told me, he said, if every patient was like Ruthie, you know, my job would be so much easier, because not only her willingness to accept his advice and his treatment, but her faith that the reliance on her family and her friends, and just the calm with which she approached her disease. Militello told me that, you know, we have some patients who come in here and they want to second guess every single thing I do and we try to do for them. They want to go get second, third, fourth opinions. And I look at them and think, you're not going to get better care, you know, but you can't face the possibility of death. So you're just trying to find some way out. And in fact, they hasten their own death.
It occurred to you and Julie, your wife, when Ruthie got so sick and neighbors were raising money and bringing over food and driving their daughters to school, that as much as you had good friends, you were living in Philadelphia at the time, you didn't have a community that you could turn to in that same way or accept help from in that same way.
No, we didn't, and not because the people in Philly are any worse than the people in South Louisiana, but because we hadn't been there that long. We'd only been there 6 weeks when Ruthie was diagnosed, and we had started making friends through our homeschool group and through our church and in our neighborhood, but Ruthie had been in this town for 40 years, right? And she was able to draw on a social network from my parents. You know, there were people who came up to me at Ruthie's wake when she finally died, and they said, you know, we didn't know her, but we know your mom and daddy, and they're very fine people. All those people came out to help Ruthie and to hold her up and Mike up and their children up and my mom and dad up. And I began to see throughout as this unfolded that the same social bonds that when I was 15 had held me down and held me back, they were the only things that were holding my family in Louisiana together through this crisis. And I looked at Julie one day and said, you know, if something like this happened to one of us, who would help us in Philly? We don't have that network there because I have been, because I'm the breadwinner, I've been moving around the country for years to years, following my own ambition and my own desires. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but there's a trade-off. And I was seeing now by what was happening to Ruthie that the trade-off she made of limiting her ambition to stay right there in town was paying off incredible dividends now that she was in the middle of a life or death crisis.
Well, what's so interesting about that and about that aspect of the book for me is that I don't have a connection to any one place in that way. My parents are from different cities and we lived one place when I was very young and then we moved, and I have ties to certain towns, but there's nowhere that I can say this is my hometown. And I don't know that I thought to miss that until I grew up and knew people who did have a hometown. Is it something that you didn't think to value until you recognized not everyone has that?
Well, not only did I not value it, I disdained it because for me, prior to all this, small town life meant small-minded life. It meant, it meant looking at people from the outside or from the big cities with suspicion. And yet, when this happened, I began to see these people that I'd grown up with in a completely different way. And it was astonishing. I remember just thinking, how is it that I missed all this all these years? When I went to her wake, they had it at the Methodist Church in which we had grown up. This is a town of 1,700 people. And mind you, after Ruthie got sick, they threw a fundraising concert for her and raised $43,000 in one night. People were coming in paying for hot dogs with $100 bills, because they loved Ruthie Lemming. And people would come up to me, and I was standing in line with my family, and they would say, "Sir, you don't know me, but this is what your sister did for me when she was my teacher," over and over and over. And I began to think, what kind of woman have I been living with all these years? And I could see the value of Ruthie's life, the small town life and these small town people. These people were saints. They really were. And I thought they were just so ordinary. I was proud of them. I mean, they're nice people, but this is what happened there. And it absolutely rocked my world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Kevin in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Well, it's just ironic. I just flew back from New Orleans at a cancer conference and, was reminded once again about the fragility of our lives and how transient our existences are. And it was also interesting because I spent my summers in San Francisco. My uncle was a foreman over at the Crown Zellerbach paper mill out on the river. And the Methodist Church you alluded to was where one of my cousins ended up getting married. And I can recall going, there as a child. I think as I've gotten older, can also relate to a lot of what your author is talking about. At the end of the day, we're here briefly and we're gone. And, the question for all of us is, what village do we come from and how well do they know us and, what do we give to each other? So I will leave it at that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you so much for making that point. I don't want people to hear me on the radio or read my book and think that we have to move to a small town. Not everybody can do that or should do that. But everybody has to find their own village, whether it's in your church, in your school, in your neighborhood. You need to reach out for community. I had never thought about it except in a theoretical way. In 2006, when I was living here in Dallas, I published a book called Crunchy Cons, in which I lamented the loss of community and a sense of communal devotion and spirit in American life. But I never really thought I should do anything that would trouble me overly much to recover that until this happened to Ruthie. And I remember well sitting there with my brother-in-law, Mike, after she died, and he got a phone call. We were taking her medical supplies back. He got a phone call, and somebody must have asked him, "How are you doing?" And he said, "We're leaning, but we're leaning on each other."
Hmm.
And I thought, that's it. And I have to say, too, that I wasn't the only one, this person transformed. One of Ruthie's first students ended up working in Nebraska, and as an adult, she heard about Ruthie's death, got in her car, drove 17 hours to make it to the funeral, walked in there just at the very end. Well, after the funeral, she heard about what Ruthie's friends had done for her the night before in the Methodist church. They had stayed with her all night. It was an open casket. They didn't want Ruthie to be by herself. But Ruthie was not a pious. Ruthie believed in God, but she was not super pious, and neither are her friends. They brought in lawn chairs because they had all been with Ruthie over the years down to Thompson Creek for creek parties. They brought in lawn chairs. They brought in sand from the creek. They brought in a guitar. Those women stayed with Ruthie all night long, and they laughed, and they sang Brown Eyed Girl, her and Mike's song, and they celebrated her life. This girl, who Ruthie's former student, who heard about this, she said, I realize that I have to be in a place where people know me well enough and love me well enough to do that for me when I die. So she goes back to Nebraska, quits her job, and moves home.
So, Rod, how had you changed to allow you to move back to St. Francisville, feel like you are who you are, you can be the intellectual you were born to be, and you can also create a community in this place that once didn't feel like home to you?
I think that the greatest probably the best answer to that is the world looks different when you're 45 and have suffered or seen suffering. That's when you're 15. Dr. Tim Lindsay, Ruthie's physician, who's now my physician, he was significantly younger than I am, so I never knew him growing up. But he was a big part of why we moved there, because of the care he gives and the love he and his wife, Laura, give to the people in the community. He told me, Rod, you got to remember, this town has changed a lot in 30 years. You're seeing it through the eyes of an angry and justifiably angry 15-year-old. But things are different now. The people had changed, and so had I. I found that I was able, the things that made me want to go away were the things that were now drawing me back, and I wanted my kids to have. I remember my chief bully back then, right after Ruthie was diagnosed, the bully was a girl. She would organize the football players, and I was not the only one she bullied, but the phone rings in Philly that weekend, and she said, "It's me, and I just want to let you know I'm so sorry, and I'm praying for you and love you." We had not had a conversation about any of this in decades, but that moved me so much. It said, you know, people really do change.
Did she say she was sorry because Ruthie was sick, or did she say she was sorry for bullying you?
No, she said she was sorry that Ruthie was sick. We've never had a conversation about the bullying because people, we're Southern people. We find it difficult to talk about these heavy emotions. Maybe we'll have that conversation, but we really don't need to. We've seen each other since then, and I know she would not have called me. She had to call my mom and dad to get the number. She wouldn't have called me if she didn't have this love in her heart and a sense of feeling sorry for what had happened.
My guest is Rod Dreher. He's a writer for the American Conservative and former writer and editor at the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Rod Dreher. He currently writes for the American Conservative, and you may remember him as a writer and editor at the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How has your idea of ambition and properly placed ambition evolved over the past 5 years?
You know, when I was on this book tour in D.C. earlier, last week, and I gave a talk, and afterwards I went out and had a conversation with a pastor there, a young pastor, who said, you know, Rod, I pastor a group of highly educated young professionals here in Washington, highly ambitious, highly accomplished. And so many of them are eaten up with dread and anxiety over how unhappy they are because they don't want the right things. He said, it's not because they're bad. They're good people. They want to do good. But the culture of achievement that they've been raised perverts their understanding of the good life, of what can be good. Because things that really matter, Dr. Tim Lindsay told me this when I asked him what the lesson of Ruthie's life was. He said that the American dream is a lie. What do you mean by that? He said what he means is that the idea that we can be completely self-sufficient and happy by achieving things in the world and getting money and position. He said no hearse ever leaves with a U-Haul behind it. He said what your sister knew was that the things that really mattered in life was serving others and having a community and serving God, not achievement, so to speak, in the way the world sees it. And I really learned from that. You know, I think I initially began to see it in my own life when, on 9/11. We were living in New York then, and I was a columnist at the New York Post and was running across the Brooklyn Bridge to get into the towers coming down. And the South Tower came down with me standing on the Brooklyn Bridge, and I knew I had to make a quick decision, either rush ahead into the city, Manhattan, before the cloud came, or go home to look after my wife and child, because we didn't know what was happening, you know. And I knew that that was the biggest story of my life, and I wanted so badly to go there. But I thought, what if I'm killed? Julie will be a widow, and Matthew won't have a daddy. And I turned around and went back home. So it was just a snap decision, but I think the things I had learned about how much my family means to me, how much more important my family is in career, kicked in there. And that's just slowly, slowly. It takes me a long time to learn a lesson, because I have to analyze everything. But Ruthie showed the ultimate value of that. We're to be ambitious to serve others and to be ambitious to serve God, that's the true ambition. But the to be ambitious to achieve for its own sake is misleading. A friend of mine in D.C. from Louisiana said, you know, one thing I love about coming home is Louisiana is a great place to be mediocre. Well, what he meant by that was, I asked him to explain. He said, because you know what? He said, up here in Washington, everybody is so obsessed with changing the world mm-hmm. and achieving power. Down there, you can be mediocre, and they're still going to love you, because that's how Louisiana people are. They're your family. They're your neighbors. And they still want you to come tailgate with them at LSU, and that's a good life.
Do you feel like that was a choice for Ruthie, or do you it sounds like you have struggled and sort of found your way to thinking this way, and maybe it would have been easier if you were born and never wanted to leave and never imagined yourself living outside of that city and living outside of that sort of small microcosm of the world?
You know, this is something I still struggle with, because as you can tell if you read the book, I haven't fully reconciled myself to my sister's life. But I learned, and the choices she made and where I fit into all that, because Ruthie didn't have to sacrifice her ambition to leave St. Francisville to be happy. She never wanted to. She wanted to accept that. And I did not return as a prodigal. You know, I'm glad that I left. I needed to leave so I could learn some things. But now it's the season of my life to go back. And yet I struggle with Ruthie, because Ruthie and I did not get along mm-hmm. all well. And that's one thing people are surprised when they read this book. Because my sister was heroic and saintly, and yet I was the only person in the world for whom she didn't have this boundless compassion. And she had said some pretty mean things over the years, and I gave as good as I got. But I wanted so badly to reconcile with her. When she got cancer, I sat on her front porch and I had a conversation with her and asked her forgiveness. And she couldn't talk about it. She was crying and just sort of used her hand to flick away my concerns. And I thought she had forgiven me. Well, it came out later, after she died, her daughter, my niece Hannah, told me some things about her mother, that some prejudices and Ruthie had against me and grudge against me that she carried with her to the grave. And it was shattering.
I want to talk about that section. So you're with your niece, you're in Paris, you're sort of on this trip to sort of just connect and be together. And she said, you really ought to stop wasting your time trying to get closer to my sisters.
That's right.
And you said, why? And she told you what?
Yeah. Well, we had just been having an argument about whether or not it's more important to be happy or to live in truth. And Hannah had been running away from Ruthie's cancer since the time she was diagnosed. She spent a lot of time in church group or out with her friends. She didn't want to face the pain and the terror of her mother's suffering. And Ruthie let that happen because she didn't want to burden her daughter with that. But I told Hannah, I said, Hannah, if you run away from pain and difficult truths to be happy, your happiness will never be secure. You'll always be running in your life. She said, well, Uncle Rod, I need to tell you then that I don't think you and Aunt Julie will be able to get close to my sisters, her sisters Claire and Rebecca, who are still young and at home. And that's because we were raised in a home in which our mom talked bad about you. She wouldn't do it directly to us, but we could tell that she thought y'all were uppity city people and, you know, not to be trusted. I knew Mama was wrong when I started coming to Dallas to visit you and Aunt Julie and then to Philly. I could see how wrong Mama was. My sisters haven't had that experience, so I really don't want y'all to get hurt. Well, I was so upset, Chris. I started crying and I was cursing. I'm like, I can't believe that. I really wanted there to be peace between us. But Hannah said, oh, I wish I hadn't told you that. And I said, no, it's better to live in truth. So I went back to my hotel room. I wrote to a friend in Washington. I said, you know, I can't do this book. The book is a fraud. My relationship with my sister was not what I thought it was. It's over. He said, oh, no, this is not going to ruin your book. If you can affirm the truth that your sister loved you, and there's plenty of evidence that she did, and you, if you can affirm the goodness in your family in spite of this knowledge, that won't, your book will be made then. And then he said, because that was my experience in my family too. And I have found, Chris, in talking to people about this book, so many families have gone through this, because family life, like human beings, it's not a problem to be solved. It's a mystery to be lived. And that's what I'm still struggling with. But I convinced myself in the end that my sister did love me and did respect me. She was just so bound up in tradition and certainly the tradition of not expressing our emotions as clearly as we should.
The book also strikes me as containing a lot of longing for Ruthie to know that you did fully love her, that you didn't reject who she was, that you are a good person. Is there part of you that wishes she could read this and know what's in your heart, not only about the world and your values, but for her? And do you feel like somehow if she could hold some of those opinions about you, that she didn't fully understand how much you loved her?
Yeah, I think about it a lot. And my wife helped me. She said, Rod, we're Christians. We believe that Ruthie is in heaven and she's been perfected now. She gets it. Really, she gets it. Trust in that. And I think she does. But just because I understand that with my mind doesn't mean I feel it in my heart yet. And it's going to take some time. My friend Edie Varnadeau, who lives in southern Mississippi, she told me as we were getting ready to move back to Louisiana, she said, it's hard, it's big, it's real, and it's dirty. Don't expect a Hollywood ending. And she told a story about how when she was younger, her brother moved off to New York, disgusted with Mississippi, but she stayed behind. And her father said, baby, no matter what happens, you will have had the better part. And she laughed at him. He said, no, you really will, because your brother will only have his bad memories of Louisiana, of Mississippi, but you'll have something else. And Edie said, I was able, because of that, to sit by my parents' bed and hold their hands as they died and pray the Psalms over them. My brother won't have that. And she said, you're going to be able to have that with your parents one day because of what you're doing, but don't think it's going to be easy to get there.
One thing you discovered after Ruthie died and after you made the choice to move back, I guess, was that she had told your mom, somehow I know that if I don't make it, Rod will move back here and help Mike with my kids.
And that was the breakthrough right there, because for Ruthie, there was no greater thing in life than to do your duty of love to your family and to move home and take care of family. And she and Mike and the girls lived right across the gravel road from my mom and dad, and Ruthie was going to be the caretaker. You know, I was the seeker, she was the abider. But the fact that Ruthie had enough faith in me, even though she couldn't talk about it to me because I'm her brother and we fought like cats and dogs since kids, she told my mom that she had faith that I was going to do the right thing. And Mama told me that long after I had moved back. So it wasn't a manipulative thing, you know, and I cried. I was so happy that I knew my sister deep down. She knew I was a worthy man.
Do you imagine yourself staying forever? Do you imagine yourself staying until your parents are no longer in this world? What is your thought about how permanent this move is?
I hope this is the last move we ever make. We're tired of breaking these bonds. You know, I'm in Dallas right now. We had so many dear friends in Dallas. That was the most painful move we've ever made because of our dear friends here. And we don't want to do that to ourselves or our children anymore. So this will be our last move. If I can support my family, because that's the thing. Not everybody can do a move like this because there are no jobs for them. I'm a writer, so I can work wherever there's an internet connection. But I'll tell you this too, Chris. I've made my living as a writer and a thinker, as an analyst, whether I was a film critic or a columnist or editorial writer. And I'm an opinion factory. But seeing all this happen with Ruthie and with this beautiful town and talking to people about this story, I've been on the road for the book tour, and people cry when they hear this story and they want to come up to me and say, this is what it's like in my family. And people have said, sign this book. I think it's going to be, it can help me and my mom talk for the first time. I'm estranged from my brother. Maybe this will help. You know, this is so moving. It's made me reconsider my own vocation. I feel like I don't have any arguments to make anymore. I'm done with politics. I'm despair of politics now, but people still need hope. Maybe the thing to do is to tell stories. I got a review from one of the great policy intellectuals of his generation in Washington, Yuval Levin, a man I tremendously respect. And he said this is the most powerful book he's read in years because of the power of this story. I wrote him to thank him for that. And he said, you know, Rod, I spend every day analyzing data and trying to do good by coming up with policy solutions to our problems. And then I read something like this about life as it is actually lived in a real place among real people. And I realize how much more powerful storytelling is. So maybe that's what I'll do.
So novels or telling true stories, or what do you think?
I want to try to tell true stories because I'm a nonfiction guy. My wife and I argue about this all the time. She loves fiction. I love nonfiction. But when you live in South Louisiana, the real life is stranger
truth
than
fiction. Truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, when we moved down there, I was so excited because the town of 1700 had its own drag queen, Ginger Snap, who would be in the Christmas parade every year.
That is completely awesome. I would never have imagined that.
Oh, I know. And when we were standing in Ruthie's kitchen right after she died, I was listening to her friends. They were all drinking beer and eating sandwiches and telling funny stories about Ruthie and the town and just trying to bolster each other and hold Mike up. And one of Dr. Tim's wife, Laura, came in and said, y'all, did y'all hear about that one-legged stripper at that strip club across the state line in Mississippi? And I said, a one-legged stripper? That is so Flannery O'Connor. That can't be real. Well, one of Mike's firefighter buddies comes in with his BlackBerry and says, oh, no, it's real. I've been there. And he shows me a picture of her working the stump on the pole. I died laughing. I went across the way to my dad sitting on the back porch with his old buddy. I said, Daddy, it's really true. There's a one-legged stripper at Illusions. And his old farmer buddy said, oh, yeah, I heard about her. Old Terry went up there to get him a lap dance, and her prosthesis fell off. He was mighty surprised. And I'm thinking, I am a writer, and this is my heritage. Why am I not living down here? And now I am.
NPR is now doing a thing. It's mostly about race, called Code Switch. But I wonder if just the sound of your voice, if you can hear it changing when you sort of cross state lines. Because when you tell stories, you tell them in dialect.
Well, that's the accent is so rich and deep down there. And, you know, that was something, too, that Ruthie held against me. When I went off to boarding school, I changed my accent slightly, just to say the G's at the end of a word. Mm-hmm. Ruthie thought that was pretentious and put on, and she gave me hell about it. You know, I'm trying to talk like I'm from the big city. Now, Ruthie was educated. She used correct English, but she could not stand putting on airs. And that was an eternal conflict between us.
Rod Dreher is a writer for The American Conservative, formerly a writer and editor at the Dallas Morning News. His new book is called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and The Secret of a Good Life. He's in town for a book signing tonight at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Rod, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been so great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download that podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.